So what I said was, I can't even right now. Okay. What I said.
I'll leave in the good take, but just tell me what you said.
Ooh. This is the good take.
Another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. Back with me again is Keith Foster from San Diego.
What's up, Drone Strikes and Jabberjaws? That's right, I'm still doing that. And with me, as always, is Cassidy Robinson from Los Angeles, California.
Yeah, you did reverse it, though. You Missy Elliott it. You flipped it back and reversed it. You said Drone Strikes and Jabberjaws instead of Jabberjaws and Drone Strikes.
Yeah. Well, you know what? The Drone Strikes need some love.
Mm-hmm. You know, I saw this thing on Reddit a while ago, like the front page of Reddit. If you go there, it's all like the stuff that's getting the most hits or likes.
Uh-huh.
And somebody posted this, like, Today I Learned, or TIL is like one of the main subreddits. And, Missy Elliott, when she, that like nonsense phrase she says after flipped and reversed it is the phrase flipped and reversed. And I was kind of like, yeah, hello. Welcome back. Welcome to 2003.
That literally took me that whole story to figure out what you were talking about with the Reddit and the TI. I don't get Reddit. I don't lead speak.
I'm old. It's Today I Learned, the very popular subreddit.
And it's TDL?
TIL.
Oh, Jesus. Mm-hmm. That's a whole separate podcast, is teaching me bullshit.
Teaching you how to use Reddit?
Yeah, I've tried. I don't get it. I don't care.
It's basically, it's from what I can, yeah, now I'm going into it. From what I've heard, like, Reddit was like, it was supposed to be like 4chan got really gross and rapey and like meninists and like racists and stuff.
I don't even know what 4chan is.
It was Reddit before Reddit. And then Reddit was like everybody who left 4chan and wanted to have a normal place to discuss video games or whatever it is. And
there's weird shit on Reddit too, isn't
no it? Yeah, it's totally weird. I go into some weird deep dive sometimes when you're clicking into people's histories, like commenters, and then you're seeing the stuff they've commented on.
I literally don't even know how to do that.
You just like click on their screen name and they'll show you everything, like their history.
I'm 31. It's too late.
I found a subreddit called r/opioids for people who are addicted to heroin.
What?
Yeah, it got seriously real on a Friday
night. Did
you
end up on the dark web?
I did a little bit on dark Reddit. And they're like telling each other, like, you know, the person was like, it's been so many weeks since I've used and I don't think I'm going to. But if I did decide to, what would be the proper amount so I don't OD? And like questions Jesus like Christ. That. Yeah. It got super real. And like people, like, you know, like people on like Facebook take pictures of their food and stuff. There's like people showing like, this is what I'm cooking today.
No, I'm done. I don't need to learn Reddit. All I know about Reddit is it has the worst logo of all of the internet.
What, the little robot face?
Yeah, it's just like these like four shitty ovals that somebody made in paint.
Well, the internet...
Microsoft paint.
The internet, like the new thing, like, you know, graphic design-wise, not even just the internet, just in general, it's all about minimalism, right?
No, it's not minimalism, it's shitty design.
Ooh.
Like Twitter is minimal. It's, you know, it's a silhouette of a bird.
Mm-hmm.
Reddit is a very shitty design. It's just like globs. And It just is so, like, low rent that I have no interest. And especially after this heroin story, I'm like, nah, I'll just avoid Reddit. I'm fine.
I don't go to that sub often.
I did a thing this weekend.
What did you do?
I played basketball.
Basketball?
Yeah, I know. That tone of voice is appropriate. Ashley and I do improv. I've mentioned this before. And someone in the improv community in San Diego posted a thing for the San Diego improvisers that was like, hey, I'm trying to get a 3-on-3 improv basketball game going.
What?
And she thought it was like an improv tournament kind of thing. You know, like a March Madness,
basketball themed. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it turns out it was actually a basketball tournament that she had signed up for. And she was like, I didn't even really want to commit to this. And now I'm like a team captain. And so one of her players couldn't make it. They had an emergency come up.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, made me get out of bed at 9 a.m. on a Sunday. And she's like, you're my sub. And I'm like, I'm not doing you any favors. I don't know. I don't even know basketball. Like,
right.
I kind of know baseball. I can get out of the way in football. I don't even know basketball. But anyway, so I went, and it's all people I know, and, you know, only 40% of us are athletic and we're actually taking it seriously. So I was like, sure, this could be fun, I guess. At least I'm outside and I'm enjoying California weather and whatever. And then as I'm thinking this, somebody passes me the ball and it hits me right on the tip of my pointer finger, like my main thing on my left hand, and like hit me right on the fingernail and peeled my fingernail up.
Ew.
That's my nightmare. That is like that's like torture. They did that in Vietnam. turned out it didn't hurt as much as I thought that would hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to just like pop my fingernail back on, like a super badass. Yeah. And then I continued to play cause I'm a badass and I'm a baller.
Yeah. I think you're officially not a baller now for saying that you're a baller.
How many?
You lost all your baller cred.
You know what? No. How many basketball people? Or players, as they might be known in some circles, have played with a peeled up fingernail.
I'm going to guess probably a lot.
I don't think there's any way to know.
Second thing I was going to say, when you mentioned improv basketball, I immediately just thought it would be like Harlem Globetrotters kind of thing.
Oh, that'd be fun. But that's like rehearsed. Like, and they're really good at like dribbling and ball tricks
and doing tricks. But what if the gag was it wasn't rehearsed and you were bad at basketball?
This is a nightmare scenario just like waiting to happen.
But you have like the music and everything and all the cues, except for you don't make any of the baskets and you don't do anything cool. Let's do the movie news.
Okay.
We're behind and we had a bunch of stories from last week, so we're going to try and get through these quickly.
Yeah.
And we'll
I'm going to talk really fast.
Okay.
It's a lightning round.
That doesn't necessarily make it a lightning round, but let's do this. Attention, 90s kids. Netflix is bringing back Carmen Sandiego.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, Carmen Sandiego wasn't really like... Well, okay. There was two Carmen Sandiegos. There was Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego, which was more of a game show, where Carmen Sandiego was just kind of this... figure sort of in the background or a theme.
Yeah. They had to figure out where in the world is Carmen Sandiego, and they had to like
it was like
a kid's game show.
Mm-hmm.
They had to like put the clues together all I really remember is there was like one of her henchmen was called Double Trouble. Double Trouble.
Right.
And they would like sing, they had like their own personal theme songs for each henchman. And you had to like figure out the right henchman to figure out where she was.
Double the double. the rock a cappella group Rockapella.
Yeah.
But yeah. There was also the cartoon Carmen Sandiego, which I would guess this is based on. It says here on the article, a Carmen Sandiego animated series. You don't remember the cartoon? Well, I'm about to read it about
about it. No, I thought they were bringing back the game show.
It says a Carmen Sandiego animated series is in the works with Netflix and Gina Rodriguez attached to voice the title character. The series will be based on the iconic educational computer game franchise that followed Sandiego as she traveled across the world stealing national treasures.
Boo. I do remember that cartoon. It was garbage. Don't bring that back. Netflix, you still have a chance. Make the right choice. Bring back the game show.
It would also be a first for Netflix to do that because they don't have any original game shows.
What if, oh my god, what if they do this like Stephen King style, and they bring back all the original children contestants to be the contestants in this new version, but as adults, and like, and it's like a game show geared towards adults now, and she is committing far more nefarious crimes.
Okay, I was so confused. The children from the animated series, not the children who played as contestants on the game show.
No, the children who played as contestants.
I don't get it.
So it's like you were a contestant on the show in the 90s. You failed to catch Carmen Sandiego. Look at the destruction she has wrought on the world. You now have a second chance to catch her.
Interesting. Okay. What's the next story?
HBO is adapting Fahrenheit 451 into a film starring Michael B. Jordan and Michael Shannon.
An original film, or is it a miniseries?
It says film multiple times.
So, a feature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whether or not it's, like, an HBO original or...
Mm-hmm. Well, HBO has, like, their, like... They do films as well, like original films, like Behind the Candelabra and The Lonely Heart, or not The Lonely Heart. What was it called? The thing that Ryan Murphy did that's based on the Larry Kramer play. Anyway, there was that. So they do make movies as well.
Yeah, no, and I think that's, you know, with a book like this, that's a better move, or, you know, do a mini series or whatever, but. Mm-hmm. I mean, this makes sense. Wasn't Fahrenheit 451, like, one of the bestsellers now since Trump's been in office? No, that was
1984, because that was specifically after Kellyanne Conway made the comments about alternative facts, and then a specific quote from the book, like, kind of went viral, and then people started buying the book again.
I mean, Fahrenheit 451 shares similar, like, themes of
fascism. Yeah, it's dystopian, and yeah, it's about, like, an uber government that's trying to keep people from being literate and trying to, you know, dissuade the arts.
I'm telling you, I think people are going to get sick of dystopian future real fast. Mm-hmm. Just as audiences, I think, like I said, when we reviewed La La Land, I have a feeling it's going to start swinging the other way, and we're going to start getting a lot more, like, fluff and, you know, positivity and more, like, just general escapism. Because we've been kind of in this dystopian thing with, like, the young adult phase and stuff, and I just have a feeling it's going to kind of... you know, like, as the world gets scarier and scarier, you know, people are going to want to that escape. They're going to want they're going to want positivity somewhere, because if it's all gloom and doom on the news all day and it's all gloom and doom at the movies, you know, like, I just think.
Yeah,
you know, I mean.
I get where you're coming from. I don't know. It's kind of hard to say. You could talk about that for a while, and I won't.
That's true. I guess there's more sources of entertainment now, though, than there
have been. Yeah, there's that. And also, I think, like, it depends on the approach. And I would say that there's a good chance that, like, comedy could come back in a big way. Like, I mean, it sort of already has, but, I mean, and maybe in a filmic way, based upon what you're saying. But I don't know, because, like, the big argument for why we see so many superhero movies and why we see so many, like, escapist cinema right now was, like, the post 9/11 thing. Like, people don't want to be bummed out, or they want to believe in a hero.
So. And I think there's something to that, but, you know, there was a stretch when people got really sick of superhero movies. It seemed, you know, until Marvel Studios came around, it almost seemed like it was going to swing the other way. And Marvel Studios does have a very, you know, specific tone that they go for. So I don't know. Yeah. I don't mean right away. I just think by the end of the Trump administration, I think we're going to, if things keep going the way they're going with, you know, like the possibility of World War III, you know, like once Donald Trump was elected, apparently the doomsday clock is the closest it's been to midnight since, like, since the invention of the bomb, basically, which is pretty terrifying. Yeah. And, you know, sometimes I think about that late at night, and I, you know, I'm like, I like the color of Emma Stone's dress in La La Land. I'm just saying, I think people are going to get...
I see what you're saying.
But anyway, yeah, I'm into it, I guess. I never really read the book. It wasn't one I was required to read in high school, so I don't really have a connection to the source material, but I like both those actors, and I like HBO, so I'll probably give it a shot.
Yeah, that's where I'm at. I like Michael B. Jordan, I like Michael Shannon a lot, and yeah, I imagine they'll put a lot of effort into it. Has there been an adaptation of this before? I don't think so.
I think there was in, like, the 80s.
And there was a 1984 in the 80s.
I think there was... I don't care. next story.
Yeah. Seth Rogen and the Lonely Island are going to make a comedy about a fictitious film or music festival.
Yeah, so. That apparently is influenced by the Fyre Festival. Did you hear about that?
Mm-mm.
Oh my god, you didn't hear this story? It's amazing. So, a couple of rich people, I think Ja Rule might have been one of them, I don't know, decided they were going to produce this music festival in the Bahamas.
Uh-huh.
And it's all, like, DJs and, like, hip kid music. I don't know. I didn't recognize... the only name I recognized was Blink-182. But whatever. Point is, they were booking it as this, like, two-weekend amazing festival in the Bahamas. And just the way they were advertising it, it was specifically as a luxury festival. And then people started flying in, and apparently it looked more like a refugee camp. I'm not even kidding. Like, they get there, and there's just, like, these weird refugee tents sort of set up where people are supposed to sleep. You know, instead of luxury accommodations, they're, like, carted back and forth on buses. and apparently people started realizing very quickly that there was not enough food on the islands to last for one weekend, let alone two. And so the description of, like, people leaving, like, bailing on this music festival, people described as, like, the Hunger Games. It's, like, huge trending. If you look up, I think it's, like, hashtag Fyre Festival, all these pictures are going around.
So this, like, just happened?
Yeah. So the second weekend, I think, was supposed to be last weekend. But they canceled it because people were worried for their lives and left after the first weekend.
Well, the story's funny, so yeah. There's definitely material to mine there, and Lonely Island has their pulse on sort of, like, what the kids are listening to these days.
And Seth Rogen's really into, like, also current events and, and taking topical stuff and churning it out into a relevant comedy, so I'm totally in, because I can't believe you didn't hear about this story.
I really didn't.
You are going to Google that after we're done recording, because it's pretty amazing. Yeah. And yeah, so apparently next year they're talking about doing the festival again, but anyone who had got tickets this year is going to get to go for free. And there's also already the amount of lawsuits stacking up against them.
Wow.
Are insane.
That's pretty crazy. I mean, also, you know, besides this one event, I think just the summer music festival in general is ripe for parody. There's way too many of them now. They're all in competition with each other.
Oh,
and
there's a lot. I'm excited for Kaboo down here.
Oh yeah, the weird one that started in San Diego. Of course,
that one was a nightmare.
They all are. The half of the story you're telling me, I'm like, yeah, that's a music festival. Yeah, that's a music festival.
Last year, they had to call riot police.
Right. I think you were telling me about this.
Yeah, because they had some of the venue, some of the musicians in inside venues, even though there's half of the fairgrounds they weren't using. And mm-hmm. those inside buildings have capacity limits, and people didn't realize that, so they didn't get in line for, I believe it was Ja Rule. No.
It's probably Ja Rule.
No, it was Ludacris? I think it might have been Luda? I don't remember. Anyway, and that was a big reason a lot of people went last year, and they couldn't get in, and there were people getting really upset, and then people got tear gassed. Somebody got hit by a car. It got insane.
I mean, I guess there's sort of a legacy of the insane bad music, right? Because there's Altamont, which is the OG of this.
Yeah, but
and then there's the Woodstock 99, where there was all the arson and raping and stuff. And then there was I don't know. I mean, it happens. It's at the very least, usually the bathrooms flood and people are covered in poo water.
Yeah, that's true. But anyway, yeah, so I think bad music festivals are ripe for the... I mean, there's not a lot of music festivals in movies. I think the closest we've ever gotten is Wayne's World 2.
Mm, yeah, that's true. Waynestock. Although you didn't see XOXO, the Netflix original.
What the fuck did you just say to me?
You remember that story about
was this a Reddit movie?
No, basically. No, it's a Netflix original film starring the girl from Modern Family about a EDM festival in the desert. I reviewed it, and then the producer of it or something, found me on Twitter.
This was the movie! You didn't say what movie it was.
Yeah, XOXO.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I'm excited. I'm a big Lonely Island fan, and... I enjoy Seth Rogen moderately, so bring it on. Next story!
Last story, right? Well, you know what? Actually, let's just go ahead and get into the reviews. That felt good enough to me.
Alright, fuck you, last story.
Maybe next week.
This is a couple... this is a few weeks late, so yes, we saw The Fate of the Furious.
Yes.
F8, which, if you... read that phonetically, is The Fate. Fate of the Furious.
I've seen these. I've seen most of these. And I've been following the Fast franchise since Fast 5, which was the first one I saw in theaters. And I kind of went back and watched some of the other ones. I think the only one I haven't seen still, I don't think I've seen Too Fast, Too Furious, the John Singleton one. Mm-hmm. And I never saw the fourth one, which is in between Tokyo Drift and Fast 5,
just Fast and Furious. Okay,
Fast and Furious, yeah. I never saw those two, but I think I've seen all the rest.
So you jumped on board when The Rock came on, right? I saw the first one, The Fast and the Furious, and then I think I've seen half of Tokyo Drift, and then the last one I saw in theaters, I actually did see this one in theaters, was Fast and Furious with no thes. And then I haven't seen one since.
Okay. So there's I was explaining to someone today, because I mentioned that I'd seen the movie, and they were like, oh, did you like it? Blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I explained how I felt about them generally. And she was just like, oh, I haven't seen any since part two. And I was like, oh, then you haven't seen any of them. Like, you might as well have not seen any of them. Because, like, you don't need to, but they are such a different creature now.
Oh, yeah. Like, I mean, they used to be about car races. And I did appreciate that this one had a car race in it.
Yeah.
So, I guess, should we describe the movie? I don't know how you go about a review for a movie like this. It's definitely critic-proof.
Generally speaking, yeah. I can do that. So I actually didn't remember this going in, but this is directed by F. Gary Gray, who just did Straight Outta Compton. He did, like, Friday and The Negotiator, and he's a guy. Justin Lin was sort of the director who sort of breathed new life into the series after Tokyo Drift and really kind of set forth on it becoming more and more of like this big action franchise, which just sort of continues on.
No. Because Tokyo Drift was that was the one that was like direct to DVD or something, right? It went to theaters,
but it was a small, it just didn't do as well because it had none of the original characters. Yeah. But that was technically the first one that Justin Lin worked on. But they really kind of hit their stride with Fast Five when they decided let's go more into this action movie direction, and these characters are more like super spies than they are just street racers.
Well, that's also when they brought The Rock in.
Yes, who plays a police officer named Hobbs.
Also done the Fast and Furious Experience at Universal Hollywood Studios. So.
100% doesn't count. Vin Diesel is back.
The Rock is in it. He's in it more than he is half the franchise.
Vin Diesel is back as Dom Toretto, and he is on his honeymoon with...
Did you say Dom Toretto?
Dom Toretto.
It's Dom Toretto. That's his Toretto. Name.
Oh, well, people say it weird. And he's on his honeymoon with Michelle Rodriguez's character, and then he bumps into vampy Charlize Theron, who tells him, you know, you got to start working for me, and, you know, fuck your family, and you're the person I need to accomplish all this cyber terrorism. So he starts doing that, and the government hires the rest of the crew, Michelle Rodriguez included, as well as Tyrese Gibson, Ludacris,
Luda,
Natalie Emmanuel, who's the new girl. She came in, I think, in the last one, maybe the one before. They kind of run together in my head. And Jason Statham, who was the bad guy in the last movie, has come back to sort of help them. And you get some fun banter.
Scott Eastwood is brought in as this government agent that is sort of the dopey white guy.
The stuffed shirt.
Yeah, and he's sort of a replacement for Paul Walker, because this is the first one.
Since
Paul Walker died.
He doesn't really function the same way in the series, but I guess they could use him that way in the future if they wanted to.
So Paul Walker was originally an FBI, or was he FBI? I don't know. He was originally a cop undercover. The first one's Point Break.
The first one is
Point Break. And imagine if Point Break had gotten eight sequels.
It could have. I mean, I'm sure that remake was hoping for something like that.
Oh, I'm sure. But anyway,
Kurt Russell's in here as well. So basically, you know, the family has to defeat their father or their brother in action, and they don't know why he's turned on them and...
Mm-hmm. You.
There's a lot of big action stunts, as there usually is in these movies, and a lot of shit blows up.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, this movie was insane. Like, this movie totally. Was balls out insanity. I was having a blast. I cannot deny that it was fun, and me and the guys who were sitting next to me and Ashley were just, like, cracking up.
Uh-huh.
I will say something. I do enjoy big, dumb action movies that know exactly what they are completely mm-hmm. self-aware, and are just into packing as much entertainment, you know, per frame as possible. I mean, it's ridiculous. The Rock basically has super strength. Mm-hmm. At this point, Vin Diesel, we can pretty much just call him what he is as a car elemental, right?
Yeah.
Summons forth the nature of car. Like, it's insane. There's a moment where there's a hack off.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of my favorite moments, because they still function in the way of, like, hacking movies from the late 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's just ridiculous, cheesy fun.
Mm-hmm. And everybody's invincible. Like, nobody, like, the everybody survives everything.
Literally. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, good for them for coming up with this many creative ways to use cars.
Uh-huh.
But seriously, at this point, how has there not been a Transformers crossover?
I'm glad there hasn't been. But, you know...
Are you kidding me? You wouldn't love a Furious Transformers cinematic joined universe?
Well, they might be under different companies, which would be the only reason that hasn't happened yet.
The Rock punching Optimus Prime in the face. I mean, there's a part where
I would be more interested in the human characters of those Transformer movies with this crew that I've already come to know and love, rather than whatever bullshit Mark Wahlberg
is an inventor. Thing.
Yeah.
I'm an inventor. I invent things.
It's a Transformer.
I find a Transformer, guys. Yeah, this movie, I mean, it's not good by any means. It's not a good movie.
Good is a relative term.
It doesn't make sense.
No, it is not artistically sound.
There's a moment when, like, you don't know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of sold the movie on that, some of the marketing. I mean, really, they sold the movie on, we made another one of these. but there's this, you know, like, why would Dom do that?
Right.
Dom doesn't turn his back on family. I don't know why that was Mark Wahlberg. I'm an inventor. I can't invent a reason for Dom to do that. And it's so contrived. It's literally just like Charlize Theron hands him a cell phone and he's like, oh yeah, you're right, I gotta do literally everything you say. And there was a part of me that was like, oh, maybe this movie's gonna take a turn and it's like evidence of him looking at child pornography.
That would be
It's not that. I thought maybe he was a Terminator. Like, maybe this isn't even Dom. She's such a good hacker. She hacked into, like, a robot duplicate. And really, would that have been any more ridiculous than the things that do happen?
No, the movies have gotten progressively more and more insane and amazing. Here's the thing. You talk about good or bad and how do you judge these movies. If I'm five kind of has its own vibe, because that's a little bit more of just like a straight up heist film. And I think of the new batch, it's still my favorite. Six and seven really blur together in my brain. I have a hard time really. I mean, I know one had Luke Evans and the other one had Jason Statham. Other than that, I can't really tell you which set piece was in it in which movie. But while I'm there in the theater, sitting down, watching them, even as this one, I was like, oh, I guess I'm going to another one of these. I always have a ton of fun. Like, I don't know what it is about the way, like, it is slightly, it's that they know what they're doing. There is a self-awareness there. But even that, like in other action movies, especially dumb ones, can seem like a cop-out or can kind of seem like they're... you know, smart alecky or something like that. This doesn't have that. There's a certain amount of sincerity mixed with the self-awareness that just, it makes it totally agreeable.
Yeah.
Also, and this has been pointed out by other critics, but it's worth mentioning that for as popular as these movies are, as big as they are, it's how much box office they have. It's one of the only big box office action blockbusters that has a totally mixed race cast and mixed gender cast where nobody talks about that.
You know, that's true. I honestly didn't even notice that until you just said it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, I mean, they're big, dumb fun.
Yeah.
They're big, dumb fun. Like, The Rock is popping off one-liners, literally punching through metal, just breathing on people and they fall over. You know, Jason Statham reminded me, oh yeah, I enjoy Jason Statham. I haven't in a long time.
He was really good in Spy, but yeah.
I was just like, where'd you go, Jason Statham? There's a very ridiculous set piece with him late in the movie that I don't want to spoil. Because if you haven't seen this movie, it's just... see it in theaters. Because I'm not going to watch these at home. You know, like, they're... they're the epitome of a popcorn movie.
Yeah, one and done.
Yeah, they're just...
yeah.
This is what I'm talking about when I'm talking about escapism. I think... we're going to get this tone a lot more for action movies versus Dark Knights. And I know Dark Knight was a long time ago. Save it, Twitter. our Twitter's just going to blow up over that one. But like, you know, Batman v Superman, that kind of thing. Like, I think just the fun, lighthearted, totally irresponsible action is part of what's so appealing. It's you know, the stakes are high for the universe, but at the end of the day, I know everything's gonna be okay
in the world of this group of people.
Yeah.
We should talk a little bit about F. Gary Gray's influence on the movie, seeing as this is his first entry in it. And I'll say that when it comes to the action set pieces, I saw this on one of those XD like screens that's like half the size of an IMAX. So it's big, but it's not that big. But I was, you know, it blows everything a little bit. So I was watching that, and I was really like trying to follow the action. And I don't think F. Gary Gray is as good at doing the action set pieces as Justin Lin or even James Wan, who did the last one.
There's ridiculous
action. I mean, it's big, and there's a lot of spectacle, and there's some really well put together set pieces, but especially when it comes down to the hand-to-hand combat, he tends to sort of rely on shaky cam or fluid camera work, and he gets really, really close into the frame when it's that big. It kind of just looks like a blurry mess.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because one of the things I did want to say about this movie is, I mean, these movies' budgets have got to be redonk by now, right?
Yeah, they're hugely high.
Yeah. So the first little bit felt kind of cheap to me.
Oh, the race car?
The prologue with the race car. You definitely know where they used their budget and when. I'm pretty sure the scenes with dialogue, they got those in like one take. Because they were like, come on, we can't spend all this time on your lines. Like, we got to get to the submarine.
Right.
So, you know, I felt like the movie, even just the production value, felt very mixed to me.
I think that is kind of a commonality between them, where they definitely, especially for like the establishing stuff or just like the story bits, they tend to like, it is a lot more kind of shot in a set kind of thing.
Which is fine.
For those set pieces, they really blow it out big, and especially the final one, they try and outdo each movie. But I will say, I think this movie is a little bit smaller in scale than the last two. If I'm remembering the set pieces of those versus this one, I came out of this one going like, I know, I'm telling you. I mean, the stakes are higher, but the actual set pieces themselves look a little bit more contained.
Okay.
And it's like the big one on the nuclear submarine is a lot of fun, and it's great, and it has a kind of almost a Mad Max-y sort of vibe to it. And I had a lot of fun watching that. But and there's another one sort of in the middle where they're like shooting grappling hooks at each other to try and hold Dom in place while he's like revving up his engine, and that's
but he's
that
a
one's
car
a lot of fun.
So we know that's not going to work.
So that's not going to work. And then there's that one at the beginning, and that's kind of it. Now I kind of seem to remember, like with the other ones, there's like three pillar ones, but there's usually a couple really big small or like fairly big smaller ones in between. This didn't have as many. This didn't have as much hand to hand stuff, but you did have that really fun set piece with that you mentioned with Jason Statham at the end, which is different for this franchise, and it really it utilizes him as a physical martial artist, I guess, if you want to call him that.
Yeah, I would. I mean, that's where he came from.
Yeah, and it utilizes Jason Statham in a way that I felt like the other movie didn't. So I thought that maybe like scaling it down in some ways was smart. But
I mean, the only thing I'll really say about it, critically, because like I said, I mean, we know the acting's not the best. It's not the worst. It's whatever. You know, like I said,
it's par for the course.
They got in one take. But I will say it maybe was a little long.
Yeah, it's what 2:16.
I think it was longer than that. I thought it was like 3 hours.
I think that's how it felt sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's some draggy parts.
Yeah. And, you know, if I'm grading this against all cinema, I'm going to give it like a C-, but a good C-. Like, you know what I mean? To me, it's just a overblown, high-budgeted B movie.
Yeah, so go ahead.
I enjoyed my time in the theater, but does it really say anything else other than, you know, the importance of family? not really.
No, yeah. I mean, like I said, if you're looking for this movie for anything other than exactly what you know you're getting from them, I mean, there is a way to do these kinds of movies worse. Like, if there are such things as bad action movies, and
for sure, and it's not.
If you see something like the last Die Hard, that was pretty fucking bad, or like the A-Team adaptation, which kind of aspired to the same thing, was not very good at all. Even like the Olympus movies are not nearly as entertaining. So they have figured out a formula here that combines the elements of like the group dynamics and the humor, and I think you are invested in these characters a little bit more than you would be otherwise. I do credit them at doing some things correctly film wise, even if they're not aspiring for a ton of meaning. I'd say it's like a B-, but I would say they kind of all are at their best.
Okay.
It's really those first couple that are really not that good. Once you get to five on, they really kind of honed in on this formula, and they can kind of keep going with it,
right?
Yeah.
How they got this? How they got here? Like, that's insane. I mean, when did the first one even fucking come out?
Like 2001 or two?
Yeah, that's 2001. That's nuts. They've been making these movies for 16 goddamn years.
That is crazy to think about.
And so the fact that they've been able to reinvent it, but keep it more consistent than a lot of franchises, yeah, I'll give them credit for that.
The other thing I was going to say is these movies are basically like Dragon Ball Z, because nobody's actually ever dead. And when they come back, all the bad guys turn into heroes later.
Yes, that's for sure. But I mean, Paul Walker is dead in real life, so he's done.
Yeah, that's the only way. That's the only way to escape this franchise is you gotta go. And I also thought, speaking of that,
yeah, let's take a real quick trip into spoiler town.
No, there's no spoilers here. All I was gonna say is that Paul Walker died via flaming car crash, and the movie opens with a flaming car crash.
I think that's how he would have wanted it.
Maybe.
Yeah, let's move on to our Netflix homework, shall we?
Yeah, the movie that I assigned you last week was Electric Boogaloo, The Wild Untold Story of Canon Films. A documentary came out in 2014. Do you want to describe it?
Yeah, this was a history of the independent film company, the Canon Film Group, Incorporated. Basically, just as a recount of all the movies they made and some of the maybe executive decisions that went into why the movies were sort of a certain quality and tone.
Right. The two founders, Menachem Golan and where was the other guy?
Yoram
Globus. Yeah. They're from Israel. They sort of they started like doing their version of like American genre movies over there, and then they caught enough steam or got enough money to kind of move into Hollywood in the late 70s, and they started making their kind of idiosyncratic action movies in the States, or just genre movies in general, because they do like teen movies and that kind of stuff too. And of course, most famously, named after the documentary, or named from the documentary, the Break-In movies, Break-In and Break-In 2 Electric Boogaloo. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you know, I think it's actually really fitting that we're reviewing this the same week we're reviewing a Fast and the Furious film.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that there is a legacy of the type of movies they've made that fits into the type of action fare we see today on a much larger budget. These kind of high budget exploitation films have sort of become the new normal.
Oh yeah. I mean, they even, at the end of the documentary, they talk about how the one cousin went on to make that other movie studio that has led to some of the movies like White House Down and shit like mm-hmm. that.
Avi Lerner, right?
Yeah.
He's a name that I've learned a long time ago when I started, like, seeing everything, where if it was a certain kind of movie like Drive Angry or, like, The Mechanic and some of these movies, I would get a vibe, or, like, Righteous Kill, I would get a vibe in the middle of the movie, I was like, I think this is an Avi Lerner movie, and then I would see for the production credits, I'm like, yep, called it.
Although, I will say, I do think that over time, the budgets have gotten a little bit bigger. But mm-hmm. that sense of fun and campiness has sort of mm-hmm. gotten lost, which I don't know that with Canon Films, it was necessarily entirely intentional.
I would say probably most of the time not, except for the case. I mean, they did. What's crazy, if you look at the documentary, is they have like all these talking heads of the people who worked with them. And generally, everybody is just like talking all kinds of shit. Mm-hmm. For the most part. And then at the end, they kind of fit it in. But we were all a big, happy family. It was a good experience, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have actually pretty talented directors at the helm of some of these movies. Toby Hooper doing Life Force through Canon. Who are some of the other ones? Some of the bigger ones I'm forgetting right now.
Godard at one point.
Oh yeah, Godard did a movie through them. The one with Molly Ringwald.
Uh-huh. I believe Francis Ford Coppola's name flashed up there very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I mean, it's very similar in a way to like the Corman Factory.
Mm-hmm.
How it ran in the 70s and 60s and late 50s.
Cassavetes.
Yeah, John Cassavetes made some of his last work with Canon. But almost like in reverse. It was where everybody went when they couldn't make movies in regular Hollywood anymore. So they would kind of go back and make these cheaper exploitation pictures with Canon, where, like Corman, they would sell the poster at a film festival without a plot or even a script and say, we can get this to you in X amount of weeks. And they would have to, like, you know, hurry the finance, and the production would be pretty rushed, and it would be what it would end up being. Mm. But you know, I think you can credit Canon with a few major trends in 80s action cinema. I mentioned in the last podcast that they were the ones that really brought the concept of the ninja movie yeah. to the United States.
Yeah. Which I didn't, that was kind of a fun surprise for me. Mm-hmm. It was basically like everything I was into as a kid.
Yeah, pretty much. But
probably shouldn't have been, considering that most of these were pretty...
risque.
Yeah. Like, yeah, so I don't know. I did think that the story was interesting. I liked hearing, like, I didn't know a lot of these movies were connected the way they were.
But it makes sense once you realize, right?
Oh, my
right?
God, yeah. Like, I loved, oh, God damn it. What's it called? The He-Man movie.
Mm-hmm. The Masters of the Universe.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous. It's not good. But, you know, I thought it was fun as a kid.
Or Superman 4.
That was, again, when I was a kid, I liked that one because I liked the fight with the Nuclear Man. but, yeah, I don't know. It was, I don't know, it was, like, it was cool to see sort of the behind the scenes of that and, like, get these connections to movies. What did you think about the documentary itself, though?
The documentary itself. If on a formal level, I think it suffers a little bit from, they want to tell the whole story from beginning, middle, and end. And there's a lot to tell. And there's, there's specific movies that they kind of will stop and take a breather on with Electric Boogaloo was kind of a big hit for them. They talk a little bit, they talk at some length about The Apple because that was like one of their first big flops and now is kind of a camp classic. They just did a midnight screening of that here at CineFamily.
Oh, really? I was thinking that would be a really fun one to watch.
Oh, it is. Oh, boy. You got to see The Apple someday. It used to be on Netflix. It might still be. But yeah, so they talk about like, you know, them finding Chuck Norris and doing the missing in action movies and that kind of stuff. But they have so much to tell that I feel the movie as a whole is kind of rushed. It really feels like they're going from thing to thing to thing to thing to thing. And
yeah, that's what
it doesn't feel like. It has a lot of a structure generally.
Well, I wanted a little bit more of like the backstory and really it's basically just like and then they made this movie, and then they made this movie, and then it's just sort of like a greatest hits kind of thing.
Yeah, I would say if there is like a foundational story, it's sort of a character piece on Menachem Golem. Yeah. Because they talk a lot about his influence on the films itself, on like in his aesthetic approach.
But that's
and like,
what I mean. That was pretty, to me, that was pretty thin. Like,
yeah,
because I wanted to know more about him, because the picture they painted, I was like, okay, so this is, this is just, it was he an Israeli Ed Wood that just happened to get his hands on some more money?
Basically.
But, you know what I mean? Like, I felt like I didn't ever really get that full picture. Like, I didn't get that character story. I got mostly just, like, and then they made this movie, and then they made this movie, which was fun, and that's kind of why you watch documentaries like this.
Right.
You know, but I guess I just wanted some more of, like, the stories. Like, that's what I found interesting, was...
Yeah. I mean, the truth is, for a lot of these films, you probably could tell a whole documentary on each film.
Yeah.
Because they all have these crazy production schedules and these crazy demands from the studio and, like, you know, the story of, like, how they flop or how they surprisingly do well or when a critic would like them or that kind of stuff. Each one of these movies has their own story worth telling. They couldn't do that. And so what you end up with, yeah, is mostly just kind of a linear... greatest hits, yeah, as you said,
and some of the directors were like, we, you know, really enjoyed working there because they had all this freedom. Others didn't because they didn't like the pacing and the budgeting. You know what I mean? Like, I never knew how this movie was trying to present canon films, because it seemed like sometimes they were glorifying it, like. When they were talking about the horrifying rape scenes in the Death Wish movies, and there's like this fun music underneath that's usually reserved for documentaries, when it's like that crazy story, and it's like, well, okay, how do you want me to feel about this? Like, do you want me to be jazzed about the graphic rape, or like, are we like, you know what, maybe that could have been pulled back on? I don't know. You know what I mean?
I think that the tone that they're going for, specifically with like their approach to sexuality in general, Cannon's approach to sexuality in movies and nudity, is this kind of their movies, when you're watching them, you never know what's going to happen next. There's sort of an untetheredness to it, mm-hmm. and that's sort of, for better or worse, what makes them worth talking about today, is the fact that, like, today, like, everything is kind of focus grouped to death.
Mm-hmm.
And even a movie like Fast and the Furious and that kind of stuff, they have a formula down. They know what the audience basically wants to see out of these things, what they don't. They know, like, what's the level of acceptability for the demographics they're trying to hit. But Cannon didn't really have that. They were making their movies so fast, and they were making them so cheaply, and it was the 80s in general. Everything was kind of in the air when you're talking about ratings and what's acceptable and what isn't, because you're between two pretty distinctly different tonal time periods of 70s filmmaking and, like, later 90s filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this kind of anything could happen kind of thing. So, yeah, when they show, like, stuff like they would sprinkle in rape scenes in otherwise normal genre pictures just to have nudity.
No, I get that.
Maybe I'm a little less affected by that just because I've seen so many documentaries about exploitation films that I understand that tradition.
No, I mean, I kind of do as well. It's just they don't even really
comment on it.
Yeah, it's just...
Yeah, so perhaps I'm filling in the blanks in my head.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I just feel like it's sort of like it sort of gave me the same vibe as, like, the National Lampoon thing. It was just like, oh, those crazy boys. And I'm like, okay, like, I don't know. Maybe we should pause and talk about it a little bit. It felt jarring because it was like there was definitely a tonal imbalance between.
But there wasn't like a dissenting voice on it. Like, this is actually pretty reprehensible, and by today's standards, we wouldn't do this now.
I'm not like that, saying they have to damn it so much as, like, stop and let's talk about it.
Right.
Like, you know, they, like, it was just like, yeah, there was a lot of violence. There was a lot of nudity. They put tits in everything. And yeah, sometimes, you know, they were these horrifying rape scenes. And then Alan Quartermain came out, and it was supposed to be like Indiana Jones, and I don't think there were titties in that one. I don't know. You know, like, it was just sort of glossed over, whereas, like, the exploitation factor to me was such a big influence that it felt a little disingenuous to just sort of gloss that over. You know what I mean? Like they talk about Ninja 3, The Domination, and the one guy is like, well, yeah, they had to make her, because the problem with it was that nobody would buy that a woman could be a ninja.
Right.
And, like, that's the story that they still think. And I'm like, what?
Like,
you know what I mean? Like, let's unpack that a little bit.
I think what you get here, for the most part, is, you know, most of the talking heads in the documentary are the people who actually worked on the films.
Yeah, but...
So you have the directors, you have some of the producers, you have some of the actors.
And some
of them... But you, like, don't really have a lot of... you don't have, like, critics in there, or, like, film historians, or people like that, talking about it, who would contextualize it more, like we are right now. Mm-hmm. I think that the tone that the movie's going for, the reason that they don't pause to make mention of sort of the sexual politics and that kind of stuff is, A, that's, I think, ultimately, again, we're dealing with the movie's moving at such a clip that they don't really pause for much.
Mm-hmm.
And B, I think ultimately what they're trying to stress is that there was no political correctness in these movies, and that was, for better or worse, what makes it memorable.
I guess. I don't know. I felt like there were some weird tonal.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously people, especially younger people who
my God,
only know, you know, only think of or only can imagine a film being made with those kind of things in mind, will still, by today's standards, be shocked by how acceptable a lot of that stuff was. And those kind of, like, sketchy sexual politics and that kind of stuff was pretty acceptable in just about everything. I mean, there's almost a rape scene in 16 Candles, and that was like sold to teenagers.
No, I mean, I get it. It's just, that was just an example of things that I felt the movie was glossing over. And I think you said it. It's like, you know, the movie wasn't long enough to tell the whole story, but like, I don't know, maybe spend less time on a few handfuls of movies. And
I get what you're saying.
Reminded me of that National Lampoon documentary, because it was like, it just sort of left me feeling a little empty. Like, I felt like I didn't get the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, it's a little bit more of a coffee table movie rather than a novel.
Yeah, and it's,
if
it's
you will,
a little, I think it's a little overly celebratory is my problem with it. Is even though they're talking shit about these movies a lot of times, they're like, oh man, I can't believe this production or whatever. They're doing it in such a like tongue-in-cheek way that it's like, I can't believe they got away with it. You know what I mean? It just
right.
It felt like they were just totally celebrating the canon film model, even though it was clearly flawed.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I disagree with you a little bit on it. I don't think it's necessarily celebrating so much as just acknowledging that it was a time and place that only it could have happened then.
But that's what I mean. I didn't get that from the movie. They very rarely talked about the time or the place. Like they just said, you know, they didn't talk about how, you know, this was the 80s and the trends that had been set by the exploitation films of the 70s and 60s. Like, they didn't go into that history at all. They're just like, yeah, two, you know, cousins who loved movies and wanted to make movies. And, like, there wasn't quite enough of the character story. There wasn't quite enough of the dirt, you know, the behind the scenes scoops. And there just wasn't enough sort of like film analysis. It was like they were trying to sort of cherry pick all of that. Mm-hmm. And to me, it left me feeling a little empty.
That's fair. Yeah. I think I feel that to a lesser extent, only because the subject matter is so idiosyncratic itself that I think that it fuels the engine of the documentary enough that it's just being made almost. But yes, I agree with you that the movie does lack a certain amount of structural rigor that could make it work better as a story.
It honestly reminded me a lot of that National Lampoon documentary we watched.
A lot. Yeah, I would say I enjoyed it a little bit more, maybe just because I'm a little bit more of a movie geek kind of thing.
They have more, like, actual footage, you know, because the other one's like a radio show and a magazine, so you don't get to, like, see the schlock hands-on. So, you know, I'll say maybe this is a little more entertaining, but quality-wise, I'd say it was about the same for me.
Okay, yeah, that's probably fair. What did you have for me next week in the Netflix homework?
Next week, I don't know if you've actually seen this all the way through or not. I picked Blazing Saddles, the classic comedy by Mel Brooks.
I have seen that. You're gonna have to pick something else.
You motherfucker.
I know, we should have discussed this before the show.
No, that's all right. I have a backup. Another comedy classic that I'm not sure if you've seen, Spinal Tap.
Yeah, we did it for Netflix homework before.
Fuck your face. Okay. Last pick. This one I'm pretty sure you haven't seen because it's a Netflix original. It's called... This one's a newer one. It's called... I have to find it. Sorry, you caught me off guard by having seen two of my picks. I don't feel at home in this world anymore.
That's the name of the thing, or are you having an existential crisis on the podcast?
That's the name of the movie. Okay. I don't feel at home in this world anymore. Starring...
Melanie Lynskey and Chris Dubeck?
Yes, and Elijah Wood.
Okay. Yeah, we could do that. That's brand new.
Yeah.
That was released in February.
Yeah. That's why it was my safety pick, Dick.
All right. Yeah, we can do that. And that's the show.
I was also thinking this might be fun. Maybe we should do a round where we get people to send in picks for us.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I used to mention that at the end of the preamble or whatever, or at the end of the show when I do my show notes. If anybody wants us to review something and we haven't seen it, you could, you know, if you're just like going through the Netflix queue and you're like, oh, that looks weird, I would never see it, but I would wonder what they would think about it. Tweet it to us all the time at Jabber Podcast. Tweet any movie you want us to see, and I'll let you know if we've seen it or not, and we'll definitely put it into consideration or end up reviewing it.
And if we've seen it, Cassidy will say, I already saw it. Fuck you.
Or if it's a situation where one has and the other hasn't, we can put it on each other's lists of possible entries later. But yeah, we take requests.
Sure.
So, yeah, that, again, that's at Jabber Podcast. If you want to tweet it to us, you can also email us at jabberinthedrone.podbean.com. You can follow me individually at BC Cassidy. And where can they follow you?
You can follow me at Keith Foster Kid on Twitter, Instagram. You can also check out my show Tonight in San Diego. It is a late night talk show in the vein of Conan O'Brien, Jimmy Fallon, that kind of thing. Late night variety show. It focuses on San Diego talent. We're on a hiatus right now. We should be coming back in 2 weeks, something like that. But you can always check us out at tonightinsandiego.com. So that's at Keith Foster Kid. And Tonight San Diego at Tonight San Diego and Tonight San Diego .com.
All right. And if you want to stream us, you can find our regular archives at jabberinthedrone.podbean.com, which is where we keep our RSS feed and all that jazz. But you can also find us and stream us at Stitcher Radio, iTunes, Pocket Cast, Podbean. I already said that. Player.fm, Google Play, and the Windows Podcast Network. And what else? Listen to The Listening Party. They just released a new episode this week. And Patrick at Make Dad Read Comics and Almost Educational, Mascot Diaries. And Keith, if you have any friends that do podcasts, you're more than welcome to pimp them out here.
I don't.
Okay.
I don't know any. I there's a bunch of like comedians and stuff.
Not famous ones that don't need our help.
No.
Okay, well then that's the show.
All right. Let's get Canon Films to all right. We need a script. And we're going to get the ninjas and they're going to machine guns and who can we get the star? We're going to give it to Gosling.